The late architecture critic and author Jane Holtz Kay had a radical vision for the United States. She wanted a society where people could choose to live without cars. Her 1997 book, Asphalt Nation, How the Automobile Took Over America and How We Can Take It Back, made the argument that our reliance on cars requires massive government subsidies and that our car-centric culture is hurting our health, our economic competitiveness, and our environment. Holtz Kay calculated that in less time than it takes to read this sentence, Americans riding around in cars and trucks will dump 180,000 pounds of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, adding to global warming. That prompted the New York Times to call her a prophet of climate change. Holtz Kay also called suburbs carburbs and pointed out that when automobiles are the only available means of transport, the young and the elderly who can't drive become dependent on rides, and the poor who can't afford cars become marginalized. Jane Holtz Kay died earlier this year at the age of 74, and today we're looking back at her work and asking if her ideas are still relevant. With us is Jane's daughter, Julie Kay. She joins us from Argo Studios in New York. Julie, welcome.
Thank you for doing this program.
And also Joshua Switsky, a senior planner for the city of San Francisco. He joins us from his office in San Francisco. Joshua, welcome to you too.
Thank you very much.
And Julie, first, your mother was raised in the suburbs, but she eventually decided to give up her car and move to the city when she began writing the book Asphalt Nation. So she really did live according to the ideas she was talking about.
Well, I think she would say that she grew up in the streetcar suburbs of Brookline, Massachusetts. I think she very deliberately chose to live as an adult and when raising us as kids in a way that was not as car dependent as when we think of the classic suburbs now. And she did give up her car quite deliberately when she started writing Asphalt Nation, but she was always a reluctant driver. She fostered a lot of independence and reliance on public transit, and myself and my sister, but she also was happiest when she was not behind the wheel of a car.
And as I understand her from reading about her, she came to her beliefs aesthetically, in the sense that she became aware of what we were losing in our cities and of what was replacing what we were losing. Is that a fair way to describe how she came to this?
I think that's a very fair way. She started off early and for a short period as an art critic, and I think then moved into looking more at preservation on a building-by-building level almost in Lost Boston. And from that streetscape, looked at regional planning throughout New England in her Preserving New England book, but I think really hit her stride in many ways in Asphalt Nation by looking at the larger impact of how do we live, what's happening to our climate, to our culture, to our inequalities within the United States because of how we're planning around cars and the way we live.
She saw this in a gigantically big picture way.
She did see it in a gigantically big picture way, and she also saw it and lived it in a very day-to-day way of what makes us happier, healthier. My mother was not into Spartan existence and was not trying to feel car deprived in any way. I think many times when people think about giving up their cars, they feel like they would be facing a great hardship or isolated or stranded. And I think my mother was very aware of how living without a car actually in an urban environment gave you a sense of the vitality of the city and the life and landscape and the people that you might pass on the street and interact with in a way that you wouldn't when you're next to them in traffic on a highway or even on a slower suburban street.
And it's true, you do really get to know the nooks and crannies of a place when you're exploring it on foot or on bike or by subway in a different way than if you're just on main corridors in a car.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the convenience of life in that kind of environment was a big part of the appeal for my mother. One of the things I think she made me very aware of was the kind of how consciously we design the way we live and whether a design includes sidewalks, how is the parking set up, where are the transit hubs, those kinds of things.
And Josh, you come to this from the perspective of a city planner. And soon after you read this book, you went to grad school in city planning at MIT. Tell us how the book and Jane's thinking influenced your thinking.
I think the issues that she brought to light are very much the core of what most planners do across the country these days. It's really standard issue in terms of mitigating the impacts of automobiles on our cities and really creating livable cities here in San Francisco. Since I started working here over the last decade, the city has revolutionized its approach to planning neighborhoods.
What's an example of some feature of San Francisco that you would say exists in some sense because of the ideas that Jane had?
You know, it's fairly mundane, but a lot of our zoning rules now, I would say, very directly derive from those clarion calls the last few years. the zoning controls for San Francisco reflected the auto-centric 1950s mentality and hadn't been changed since the 1950s, where we required at least one parking space for every housing unit, and you know, you couldn't build a building in most of the city without building substantial amounts of parking, and it was just fundamentally undermining the quality of the fabric and place that San Francisco is. It's one of the most walkable cities in the country. We've been gradually changing those rules to not require parking with every building and to require, you know, ground floor retail and walk-up townhouses and things like that with all new development to really ensure that walkability is really the fundamental premise of every design and every rule.
That's interesting. So you allow the city to become more dense residentially, but you don't necessarily give everyone a place to put their car. Presumably, you're hoping they'll just decide, I can't have a car, I don't need a car.
As it stands right now, one-third of all households in San Francisco already don't have a car. So that's sort of the baseline we're starting with, and we're trying to make sure that we sort of hold the line there.
But this has to be very exasperating for people who need a car and spend a lot of time circling trying to find a car space that's very hard to find.
Of course. As policymakers, we try to take the broader look and always get back down to the fact this is not about everybody not having a car. This is about some people not having a car. And more importantly, it's about providing the choice and providing the housing stock and the neighborhood fabric that people without a car can find a place to live.
Going back to this idea that I can't have a car, I don't need one, I think my mother saw a world in which it was actually I don't want a car because it's easier and faster and more pleasant to go by other modes of transportation, whether it's foot or decent public transit or bikes. But I think she was also very aware of the people who get left out and left behind by cars and people who are working a job that you need a car to get to, so you need the job to support the car, and you get in that circle or cycle, as well as looking at people who are excluded because they're too young to drive or disabled or too old.
Well, right, that's an interesting point, because she looked at the impact on the elderly who perhaps can no longer drive, the young who can't drive yet. She also was concerned not just about them being inconvenienced, but about them becoming marginalized or dependent.
Oh, I absolutely think so. I think that was very clear to her when she was raising two children who needed to be driven places. She early on taught us how to use the subway and rely on it well in around the Boston area. But it's looking at all the different aspects of, you know, what makes it possible for a child to walk to school, and what does that mean if a child can walk to school by him or herself? It means that we're building sidewalks. It means that they're running into their friends and other people along the street. There's more life and action on the street, whether it's in an urban environment or a streetcar suburb or a suburban area, and giving children that kind of independence and that kind of moving, living lifestyle.
That's Julie Kay, daughter of the late architecture critic Jane Holtz Kay, who died this year. We're talking about Holtz Kay's vision of a world where people would find it easier to live without cars than with them. Also with us is Joshua Switsky, senior planner for the city of San Francisco. When we come back, we'll be asking whether Kay's ideas are also relevant to rural areas and cities where there is no public transport. Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back. We're talking about Jane Holtz Kay, who died this year. She went from being an architecture critic to a radical visionary who wanted communities designed in a way that makes cars unnecessary. With us are Jane's daughter, Julie Kay, and Joshua Switsky, senior planner for the city of San Francisco. Just before the break, Julie was describing her mother's holistic approach to planning cities with far fewer cars. The benefits of kids walking to school, more life and activity for the neighborhood, more independence for everyone. Josh, you are a city planner, so it's your job to make it possible for kids to walk safely. And you're also looking at how to plan for elderly residents.
We have a large aging population, even here in San Francisco, and safety is a big public health issue in terms of elder folks being able to walk to services, walk to shops, walk to transit, and injuries due to collisions and so forth are high on our priorities.
Between cars and pedestrians?
Yeah, and while San Francisco is one of the safest places to walk, we still have people killed every year, and we're always looking at where the hotspots are and how we can improve them before people get killed, and we know that the streets are generally not designed around the comfort and safety of people walking around. How can we fundamentally transform our streets into more livable neighborhood streets where people not just feel safe, but are attracted to walking around and want to spend time there.
Much of what we're talking about applies primarily to big urban cities, maybe traditional urban cities. What relevance does all of this have to people who live in the suburbs and really can't survive very well without a car, or in a new growth city that doesn't have much public transportation, no subway system to speak of?
The principles of walkability, you know, in terms of how we design our buildings, be oriented towards sidewalks and to have ample sidewalks at all, and to have an interconnected grid of streets that you can kind of conveniently walk around. I mean, those are principles that hold true regardless of the intensity of the urban environment you're in.
Yeah, and I don't think there's such a bright line between urban planning that works as far as making it a livable place and suburban or even rural. I think it's a combination of transportation, but also actually a couple of days after my mother had passed away, I was walking through a parking lot in a mall outside of Boston and carrying a quite heavy toddler and thinking, why did they build this way? And I stopped and I thought, well, they built it this way because they didn't think about it. Even if I have to drive to the mall, I should be able to at least, you know, hold my toddler's hand and walk safely somewhere into the parking lot and not be feeling sort of windswept and left alone. Every single car there has people in it, and yet there's no recognition in this building and design that there should be a central path or some way of doing it so that you're not at the mercy of the other driver who's texting away while they're looking for a parking spot themselves. And I think that that's kind of the smart planning that works and that's needed not just in the cities but needed everywhere there are human beings.
But what about people who live in outer suburbs or who really live in rural areas where to ditch a car is completely impractical?
Well, then I think it's at some point we all need to go somewhere to buy food and supplies and shopping, and it's looking at much more of a main street design than a sprawling design. One of the things that my mother pointed out to me years ago was, why don't you build the parking lots in the back instead of in the front? You know, make it more of a streetscape in that you leave your car in one destination and then are able to proceed from A to B to C on foot more easily.
Even if all of this sounds ideal to some people, there are more than 250 million registered passenger vehicles in the U.S. So in that sense, people have voted with their wheels. I mean, cars are useful. So how do you balance these two things?
You know, this is sort of a circular self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, for decades, the federal government has primarily invested in interstate highways and instilled through just the practice and funding of transportation infrastructure and growth patterns that have kind of reinforced these patterns. So yes, the decisions are sort of made for us all along the line.
I think one of the things that my mother did in her books and also even more so in her public speaking is open up people's eyes to another way of thinking and a way of thinking that maybe planners and people learn more formally in school, but that those of us sort of on the streets and on the roads feel intrinsically. So for instance, she pointed out that there was a design for the sort of fast food stop on the highway that had the one fast food restaurant in the middle and it serviced both lanes. All of a sudden it starts you thinking, well, why are we looking at a highway with an inbound and an outbound McDonald's when we could sort of have one footprint in one place? Once you start thinking, why am I walking through the small parking lot in this way? Or why don't elderly people or young people or people without the money for the car have the freedom to get places as easily? I think it's a mindset that starts to change, and that's where the sort of political aspect comes in, and that's where there becomes more of a force for supporting bike lanes or for supporting mass transit. In New York City, when we're building a new bridge over the Hudson River that has no planning for public transit, there are actually people who live in the suburbs who are saying, give us a break. If you build this bridge without even the possibility of a commuter rail, you're dooming us to that much more time in our cars and that many more cars driving through our community to get farther away.
In fact, I think the tally is that Americans spend 8 billion hours a year stuck in traffic, and that's just the U.S.
And we're stuck. And I think that's the real question is how do we get unstuck?
Just so we don't slip into one-sided car bashing, I mean, certainly cars in many ways have added a lot of wealth to us, and they've improved our well-being because of the freedom they give us. So, I mean, there certainly, of course, is a place for cars. I mean, they have been very valuable. It's just now trying to find the right balance.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's sort of what I was speaking to before. There's people need cars for certain things, and there should be the opportunity to accommodate that. It's just about striking the right balance and not designing our entire living environments around the notion that everyone uses a car for everything.
Julie, would you say that by the end of your mom's life, she was more frustrated or satisfied with the changes she saw in our car culture over the course of her life?
I think she was aware that she was counterculture, but in the end, she was an optimist. I mean, you have to be to get out of bed in the morning and to keep writing and things. But she, I think, had seen bits of progress, and she had met people throughout the United States and internationally who got it and who were working towards the kind of change that she thought was going to help our society in many ways, and that really buoyed her.
Julie Kay is the daughter of Jane Holtz Kay, an architecture critic and author who died this year. Julie, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
We've also been talking with Joshua Switsky. He's a senior planner for the city of San Francisco. Josh, thanks to you too.
Thank you very much.
Still ahead today, author Richard Ford on his best-selling novel, Canada. News is next, here and now.